Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning Torah study, and we are glad to be with you this morning. We're glad that you joined us. It's a beautiful day here, and hopefully it is where you are as well. A couple of introductory comments this morning. One thing to let you know, for those of you who are following along, we just posted our third Hebrew study. We're going through right now with a series that is an introduction to biblical Hebrew. It's a five-week course. I set it up that way. I felt like in 5 weeks, based on a previous run, that I could get you to the place or cover enough material, let's say, so that anyone who studies and learns these concepts and these rules, and it's not too many rules, but once you learn the basics that I present in these five courses, you'll have everything you need to begin to read. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that that just enters you into the world of biblical Hebrew. There's still quite a bit to learn. I still learn every day. I don't profess to be an expert, a guru. However, it is a very rewarding journey. And at the very minimum, it puts you in a place where you can begin to look at root words, and you can use biblical language tools so that you can get a deeper understanding of the biblical text. So again, our first lesson was just sort of an introduction to the letters, the characters of the Hebrew Aleph Beit. The second one, I began to cover the Hebrew vowel sounds. And then in the third one, I picked up and took that a little bit further, a little more on the vowel sounds, and got into the initial step of what we call half vowels. So if you haven't checked those out, feel free to do so. They're on our website, unitedisrael.org, and you can see on the page we have all three videos posted in one convenient location now. So also, the other announcement I wanted to make, Jodel Onstott and Jack have, Jodel and Jack Onstott have invited the entire world to their home, July the 13th through the 17th. They've actually begun to plan what is going to be a summer youth retreat, and they have quite a few things planned. Obviously, there'll be some Torah study, some Bible study, but they also have some activities, some fun and games, including a trip to a water park locally and the World War II Museum. So it'll be some educational things, some fun things. And if you are interested in that, we have an event on our Facebook page, on the United Israel World Union Facebook page. You can read about it there, or you can call Jodel. I am not going to announce her phone number publicly, but she did allow me to put it on the Facebook page. So check it out. If no other way, if you don't have any other way to contact her, or you can't seem to figure that out, let me know, and I will help you with that. Okay, so we are presently working through the Bible's first book, the Book of Beginnings, the Book of Bereishit. And we are studying through according to the ancient triennial cycle of readings. We're working in what are called broadly the patriarchal narratives, okay? And we are in the time known as, I guess, the patriarchal period, but we're in the life of Yaakov, in the life of Jacob. Last week, you will recall that Yaakov, the son of Abraham and Isaac, Jacob as he is known in English-speaking world, got four women for himself. And for better or for worse, he now has four women. And while our story, one of the things that I wanted to bring up today is that while our story and the Bible as a whole is patriarchal in its setting, meaning the focus is primarily on these men of the Bible, I always like to point out, and I especially want to point out today, this idea that we hear often that behind every great man is a great woman. Or in the case of Yaakov, two or three or even four great women, right? The women of Jacob as we learn from our narrative, come from a place called Padan Aram, from Mesopotamia, specifically from his mother's brother, Laban's home and family. You'll recall that in last week's portion, Jacob, at the urging of his mother in fear for her son's life, was told to leave and go to Padan Aram in order to avoid the dangers associated with his brother's anger. So he leaves. And before I get into today's class, I'd like to read from Genesis chapter 27. This is from last week's class, actually maybe the week before, because I want to set the stage for what I want to cover today. So if you'll go with me to Genesis chapter 27, beginning in verse 46. I'm reading from the Jewish Study Bible, and this particular translation is not as literal. It's the Jewish Publication Society, but this is my point. Today, I just want to cover the narrative here, and we'll get into plenty literal in a few minutes. So beginning in chapter 27, verse 46, it says, "And Rebekah said to Isaac, 'I am disgusted with my life because of the Hittite women. If Jacob marries a Hittite woman like these from among the native women, what good will life be to me?' So Isaac sent for Jacob and blessed him. He instructed him, saying, 'You shall not take a wife from among the Canaanite women. Up, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take a wife there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. May El Shaddai bless you, make you fertile and numerous, so that you become an assembly of peoples. May he grant the blessing of Abraham to you and your offspring, that you may possess the land where you are sojourning, which God assigned to Abraham.' And Isaac sent Jacob off, and he went to Padan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel, the Aramean, the brother of Rivkah, mother of Jacob and Esau." Now, what we don't get in the conversation between Rebekah and Isaac is that the primary motive in her sending her son out was fear that Esau was going to kill him. What we get here is a different reason, an excuse, an allowance to encourage Isaac to go along with the plan. You'll recall that just moments before, it seems according to the text, it could be longer, but just in a previous episode in this same chapter, we see this trick that Jacob pulls on his father at the behest of his mom in order to secure the blessing. So what happens here is she goes to Isaac. She said, "I can't stand it. I shouldn't even be able to live if our son Jacob takes a woman from among the local populace. He needs to go back to my family and get a good woman like me, Isaac." And Isaac, knowing what's best for him, agrees with this, calls him in. Notice, though, that Isaac blesses Jacob here and tells him specifically to get a woman from the family of Bethuel, specifically of the daughters of Laban. And he sends him forth with a blessing, the blessing which is the blessing that has come through Abraham, through Isaac, and now will rest squarely on the shoulders of Jacob. So you'll recall that upon his departure, Jacob has a dreamy encounter. And in this dreamy encounter, known popularly as Jacob's ladder, he has a vision. And in the vision, as he sleeps in this special spot, he sees a sulam in Hebrew, what is typically understood to be a ladder or an ascent. Some have proposed a ziggurat. And so what begins to happen is Let me send a message. I am sorry. I've got one of my sons texting me. They don't know that today I'm teaching. It's a new Saturday. No. All right. So he has this dream. Some have proposed that Sulam indicates a ziggurat of sort, one of these ancient temples. But the idea is that among these promises that he's given in this dream, that ultimately through his descendants, through Jacob's descendants, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. His trip proves successful. He is on his journey, and no sooner has he arrived than his eyes behold the beautiful Rachel. And we're introduced to her. We see that this shepherdess, the daughter of Laban, catches Jacob's eyes, and it is, as we might say, love at first sight between Jacob and Rachel. Now, this particular story catches us immediately. We feel the love that Jacob has for Rachel, and we immediately get into this idea that we want to be part of this relationship. We feel for Jacob. We feel for Rachel. We feel like we're part of this mutual love. But there's more to the story, as we'll see. We get further indications that he is, in fact, in love with her. He kisses her, which some might not associate with that love immediately. He breaks into tears. He really sheds himself. He exposes himself. He is taken aback by Rachel. It's clear. The writer wants us to see this. When he lays eyes on her, he's moved. Next thing you know, he moves in with the family. And he works there with Laban for a period of about a month, it says. And then Laban approaches him. And he says, look, there's no reason that you should be doing this for free. Give me your price. And I'll make it right. And what does Jacob ask for? He asks for Rachel. So they make an agreement. They make an agreement, and Jacob offers. He's not, this isn't proposed by Laban. Jacob offers to give 7 years of his life for Rachel. Just no other questions. Just he offers that up. I'll work 7 years for Rachel. And why is that? Because he loves her that much. We later read in the story that these seem like but single days because of his love for Rachel. I mentioned last week this can be taken two ways. One way is that the time flew by. You're in love. It's 7 years or nothing. Many of us can relate. But the other side could also be true. His love for her was so great that the days ticked by one day at a time. And I think that the latter might be more like what it's really suggesting. And Jacob, after fulfilling his 7 years working for Laban, asked for Rachel's hand. And you'll recall that he tells Laban, look, my time, he's been counting these a day at a time, right? It's like I remember in the military when I was getting ready to get out, we had a calendar, and you cross off days as you count down. Well, this is what Jacob is doing. And when the day arrives and he's fulfilled his obligation, he said, okay, I've done my 7 years. It's time for you to give me Rachel. So Laban assembles all the locals for the wedding, and the ceremony begins to take place. Now, it's hard to imagine how what happens next happens. We don't know, or I don't know, specifics around these ancient wedding customs, I've read quite a bit about it, but it's hard to imagine, even given what I know. A lot of people would say, well, there's a veil, but I want to even back it up. Was there talk before to let everyone know Jacob and Rachel are getting married? Because Jacob thinks, at least Jacob thinks, that he and Rachel are getting married. I assume that Rachel thinks the same. Was this going to be a surprise? Was she just going to be, like, told the day before, hey, look, Jacob asked for your hand? And surely those 7 years they've talked about this day all this time. What were the townspeople? What were the people in Padan Aram told? Who did they think was getting married? The reader is left to just take the story at face value. We know that there's going to be a wedding. We have to assume that everyone there thinks that it's going to be Jacob and Rachel getting married. But something happens. As the ceremony and the celebration goes into the night, Laban, most likely in secret, prepares Leah. He tells her, don't worry. Now, I'm going to add some of my thoughts. I'm trying to make sense of this. He tells her, don't worry, Leah. I'm going to put you in with Jacob tonight. He gives Leah Zilpah as a maid. He brings Leah to Jacob. And Jacob sleeps with Leah that night. When morning comes, we read that he sees that it's not Rachel that he's sleeping with or has slept with, but it's Leah. Now, you might wonder, well, how did that happen? It's dark. I don't know. Maybe too much wine. We discuss these things. All these are just ideas. We just don't know. The writer doesn't tell us. But we do know that there's a surprise for him in the morning as the sun shines into the chamber. And this made me begin to think. It made me think about perspective from Leah. Something that I'd really not considered before until I began to read this week and think about today's class. See, in previous readings and in discussions about this in other conversations in previous years, I think most of the time we focus on Laban's tricking of Jacob. Sometimes we might feel a bit sorry for Jacob. At other times, we think about Jacob being tricked by Laban, and we might say that he deserved it, that he had what was coming to him. I mean, after all, he had tricked his own father. He's a trickster. He's the one who grabs the heel. He's done this to Esau. He's done it his whole life. You got what you have coming to you. Some may focus on Rachel. I mean, think about Rachel. All this time, Jacob is in love with her. Every day, I can almost imagine. Remember, these days are ticking off as single days. He probably said, we have 6 years, 363 days and 12 hours. We have 5 years, 280 days. We have four. We have three. We have two. Honey, we have 7 days. It's one day. Your dad just told me that you're mine. Imagine. We have to assume maybe that she wanted to marry Jacob as well. We don't know this, though. Here's something to think about. What we do know is that Jacob is madly in love with Rachel. But you know what we don't read in the text? That the love was reciprocated. Doesn't say. Maybe she did. Maybe she didn't. The point is, I think at times we think about Laban. We think about what he did to Jacob. We think about Rachel. Question for you today. What about Leah? What about Leah? Imagine how she felt. I really hadn't given this much thought. Jacob, rolling over in the morning, seeing her, and the shock on his face that she must have seen, the hurt that she must have felt as he jumps up and storms out to go find Laban. Now, Leah knows Jacob pretty well, too. Would you assume that to be the case? She, too, has been there for 7 years. She's seen the love that Jacob has for Rachel. She knows that Jacob has agreed to work 7 years for Rachel. She knows going into this that she's not the choice. Laban is met by Jacob, according to the story. Jacob says, "What is this that you've done to me?" As I studied this week, I thought, I hope Leah didn't hear that. Were they in the same dwelling? Did this happen within earshot of Leah? He is furious, it seems, that he's been tricked. Imagine being the butt of this joke. Imagine being the one who's not wanted in this relationship, the odd person out. Jacob continues in his conversation with Laban. He says, "I served you 7 years for Rachel." He's not happy that he has Leah. And what about Leah? See, the story forces us to focus on the other characters. We're following God's will. We're following God's plan, we think. We're following what we should be following. But allowing ourselves to take the story as it unfolds, a chapter sometimes at a time, forces us to think about each character in a new and exciting way. Laban tells Jacob, it's not done like that here. To take the younger before the older. And I brought up last week, this had to sting in a way, because he wants Jacob to understand, being the younger who's taken the blessing from the older, we don't do things like that in Paddan Aram. He agrees, and Jacob agrees to another 7 years for Rachel. Think about Leah. Does she now know that he's so madly in love with her sister that he is willing to work another 7 years to get the one he wants? He doesn't have to wait the full 7 years, thankfully for him, I guess. But he has to wait a week. Now, based on the way I'm describing this story and my own understanding and my own insight into the text, I have to wonder if these 7 days didn't feel like 7 years to Jacob and maybe Rachel. But what about Leah? Because, see, she knows that she's only got 1 week and he's going to get the one he wanted. I don't think that these 7 days were that joyous for Leah either. Today, I want to focus on Leah, because she doesn't get the focus that she deserves. I want to focus on the one not loved. And I want people to begin thinking about either themselves in situations where they have felt this burden, or about others who might be going through something similar. Because this is very, very painful. But see, we read right over this. We soften the blow of words so that we can internalize them and not feel badly for someone else. We take the edge off of painful things. Our story opens today by telling us that Leah was hated. Now, the Hebrew sane, some argue that it doesn't mean hated, but before you think about that, let me explain something to get this point across, because it's very important. When one understands the true meaning of sane, to hate, see, we tend to think hate means malice, like you want to kill somebody or you want to inflict physical pain. That's not what hate is. Hate is as difficult in some ways to define as love is. Go define love. Go define hate. These are emotions, right? Now, let me tell you some synonyms for the word hate, for the word sane. We don't need to soften this word, because I want you to feel today what Leah felt. Leah felt hated. Now, is hate the opposite of love? In our language, the word has synonyms such as aversion, extreme dislike, antipathy, something that is to be found distasteful. It doesn't necessarily have to mean a vehement hatred like you would think, because we grow up and we say, oh, you can't ever hate anyone. Oh, you can't, you know, God doesn't hate. Look, when you understand that it can mean an aversion to something, it's something you don't like, you don't like this, it's distasteful, it's something unwanted. Something unloved. Because people hate to use the word hate, they come up with softer terms. So whether you call it the name of the synonyms or not is irrelevant to me, so long as you understand that the feelings associated to someone who feels unloved can be very close to feeling hated. It's powerful. It's something so emotionally wrecking. And this is the feeling that we get when we read the story. Leah, listen to this. Leah truly is unloved. You can say that she's loved less if you choose. But that's not what Scripture tells us. She's unloved, and it's impossible. Now, and I'm telling you, I've read this in Hebrew and English all week. It is impossible to read her words without sensing and feeling the depth of her sorrow and the rejection that she feels. You cannot read her words without feeling it. I was reminded this week of a poem from the early 14th century that I read some time back, and I had marked it in one of my Bibles. It's from Dante Alighieri's Purgatorio. And it says this: in my dream, I seemed to see a woman, both young and fair, Along a plain, she gathered flowers, and even as she sang, she said, "Whoever asks my name, know that I am Leah, and I apply my lovely hands to fashion a garland of flowers I have gathered." This writer is seeking to capture the only solace that she has, is to walk in the fields and gather flowers. Because she doesn't feel loved. She doesn't feel wanted. She doesn't feel appreciated. She doesn't feel honored. She feels that no one cares for her. And as Bible students, we've been guilty through the ages of ignoring Leah's cry. Psalm 119:18 says, "Gal einai v'avita niflaot mitora teka." Open my eyes and I will look for wonderful things from your Torah. I'll be reading today from a story about Leah. It's her story. It's her story according to her own words. And it's pretty powerful. If you allow it to speak to you. Rachel is in the story, but only as she interacts with Leah. This is Leah's story. We'll get into Rachel's story. So allow me to express for you Leah's view. Don't take anything I say today as degrading to Rachel if that's your favorite. She's been everyone's favorite for thousands of years. We've got time to honor Rachel. Let me honor Leah, if you will. So we begin our portion today as the ancients divided the text in the life of Jacob. And this is Leah's story. It begins in Genesis 29, verse 31. "And Jehovah saw that Leah was hated." Now I'm reading from the Transparent English Bible, the work of James Tabor. Notice, I want you to listen for the emotions. I want you to listen for the feelings of Leah. I'm going to talk about them after I read, but I want you to get this. And the word there, hated, is sunne. It's from the root sunne. Jehovah saw that Leah was hated. And he opened her womb, and Rachel was barren. And Leah became pregnant and brought forth a son and called his name Reuven, for she said, "Because Jehovah has seen my lowness, because now my man will love me." And she became pregnant still and brought forth a son and said, "Because Jehovah has heard that I am hated, he's given me also this one." She called his name Shimeon. She became pregnant still and brought forth a son and said, "Now this time my man will be joined toward me because I brought forth to him three sons." Therefore she called his name Levi. And she became pregnant still and brought forth a son and said, "This time I praise Jehovah." Therefore she called his name Yehuda, and she stood from bringing forth. Rachel saw that she had not brought forth to Jacob, and Rachel was jealous with her sister, and she said toward Jacob, "Give me sons, and if there is not, I die." And the nose of Jacob burned against Rachel, and he said, "Am I instead of Elohim, who's withheld from you the fruit of the belly?" And she said, "Look, my house servant Bilhah, come toward her, and she'll give forth on my knees, and I will be built up also I from her." And she gave to him Bilhah, her house servant, for a woman. And Jacob came toward her, and Bilhah became pregnant and brought forth to Jacob a son. And Rachel said, "Elohim has judged me and also has hearkened with my voice and given to me a son." Therefore she called his name Dan. Bilhah, the house servant of Rachel, became pregnant still and brought forth a second son to Jacob. Rachel said, "Tanglings of Elohim, I have tangled with my sister, and I have been able." She called his name Naphtali. And Leah saw that she had stood from bringing forth. She took Zilpah, her house servant, and gave her to Jacob for a woman. And Zilpah, house servant of Leah, brought forth to Jacob a son. And Leah said, "With fortune," and she called his name God. Zilpah, the house servant of Leah, brought forth a second son to Jacob. And Leah said, "With my happiness, for daughters will consider me happy." And she called his name Asher. And Reuven walked in the days of cutting of wheat and found mandrakes in the field. And he caused them to come toward Leah's mother. And Rachel said toward Leah, "Give to me, please, from the mandrakes of your son." And she said to her, "Is your taking my man a little thing that you would also take the mandrakes of my son?" And Rachel said, "Thus he will lie down with you tonight under the mandrakes of your son." Jacob came from the field in the evening, and Leah went out to meet him and said, "Toward me you are to come, since paying wages I have surely paid wages for you with the mandrakes of my son." And he lay down with her in that night, and Elohim hearkened toward Leah, and she became pregnant and brought forth to Jacob a fifth son. And Leah said, "Elohim has given me my wage, for I gave my house servant to my man." She called his name Issachar, and Leah became pregnant still. She brought forth a sixth son to Jacob. And Leah said, "Elohim has endowed me a good endowment. This time my man will raise me, for I have brought forth to him six sons." And she called his name Zebulun. She brought forth a daughter, and she called her name Dinah. The women. When we when we first meet with the daughters of Laban, we read about these two girls. The older, or the bigger, as it's put in Hebrew, it's not indicative of size necessarily. Generally, the way that they talk about the age difference in these births and so forth is you call it the bigger and the little, or so this is the idea. But if you'll look at chapter 29, verse 16, I just want to bring this out. If you go back to our previous lesson, and I'm going to pull up, I happen to have open that reading. It says, "And Laban had two daughters. The name of the large one was Leah, and the name of the small one was Rachel." Again, not necessarily has anything to do with size. "The eyes of Leah were tender, and Rachel was beautiful of shape and beautiful of sight." The eyes of Leah were tender. Some translations say weak. And Rachel is described as beautiful of shape and beautiful of sight. And we'll start with Rachel. Everything that I just said about Rachel tells us that to behold her was to see beauty. From the perspective of the one looking, you would see what you would call beautiful. The eyes of Leah were tender. We don't yet know what that means. We're going to talk about it. But one is described as physically attractive, and the other one, Leah, who I want to focus on today, it says something about her eyes. But what does that mean? Clearly, Jacob is attracted to Rachel. But what about Leah? Most people, I think, maybe because of a contrasting view based on what we see about Rachel, Rachel is beautiful, she's got a good shape, she's this, she's that. We get the idea that Leah is not that. Like an argument from silence. Now, first of all, I'd like to say, we don't know, when we talk about shape and what's attractive, this changes over time, and it's a matter of perspective. You know, just because we see runway models today, you can look at paintings and art, that's not what the ancient world considered to be, you know. So don't think in that way. Because even if you're right, you could be wrong. But we get the idea through just our reading and our casual reading that Leah is not anything special to behold, even though it doesn't say this in the text. Here's what hit me this week. I think the two girls, what we're being told from the Torah is that the two girls both possess beauty. External, in the case of Rachel. Internal, in the case of Leah. A bruised beauty, but beautiful nonetheless. Again, allow me, I'm not taking the people's favorite and ridiculing Rachel. But let's give Leah one day, just one day. She didn't even get her 7 days in the wedding chamber. This might be the first time Leah's ever been given a voice. Both are described in terms of sight. Leah, it's what she sees. It has something to do with her eyes. Rachel, it's what others see in her or on her or about her. For Leah, it says that her eyes are rakot. The root word is rakak. It means tender, weak, soft. Her eyes are soft and tender. Now, you might then take that to be her eyes are very beautiful and soft, like the color is as. But I almost think inside her head today, it's what goes out through her eyes and not what you see looking in her eyes. Because here's the sad truth. I don't think anyone looked close enough in Leah's eyes to see inside of her. But I think the Torah tells us what's inside. I think, by the way, this root word, rakak, is translated as weak in some translations. But do you know in all 16 occurrences, every time it occurs, it means tender or soft or both? I think Scripture wants us to see the pain through Leah's soft and tender eyes. I think Scripture wants us to see her hurt, her cause, her fight, her pain, her rejection, and her mistreatment. And she was all those things. I know God certainly saw it, because our Torah reading begins, as I pointed out and as I read, and Yehovah saw that Leah was hated. No one else may have seen that Leah was hated, but God saw it and Leah saw it. Again, you could say, well, it doesn't mean what you think it means. Okay, well, it could mean a number of degrees, but the idea is that She's not loved, and she knows it, and God knows it. The reading is about Leah, the unloved. Rachel is in this reading, but here's all we get about Rachel this week in this reading. Talk more about her later. In this reading, we find out that she's barren, that she's envious of her sister, that she's blaming of her husband. If I can't get kids from you, then I might as well die. I mean, Jacob is mad at the one he loves because she's in his face about this. She seeks vindication. She can't have children. If you read the language around giving the handmaid to Jacob, it's that she says, now I'll get even, basically. She's competitive. She'll race. I mean, she's looking at fruitful Leah over here, who's just, you know, and I get it. We'll read her calls next week. She's deeply desiring to bear, and perhaps this drives it, her actions, her attitude, her, you know, whatever. But we take these stories as they come. So that's Rachel this week. It's all we know about Rachel this week. Now, some insights on Leah. From the story and the naming of the children, now with perhaps the exception of Levi, she names all the children. And in the text it says, I think he called his name Levi, so of her kids. But she names the others, and they tell us a little bit about her. They tell us what's going inside those soft, tender eyes, if we let it. They tell us of her inner feelings of low self-worth. Most focus on Rachel's inability to bear and on Leah's fruitfulness. So one of the reasons that people, even when Leah should be one that we feel badly for, we always feel sorry for Rachel. You shift to Rachel and feel sorry for her and not Leah because Rachel is barren. So we excuse her actions, we excuse everything, and we just figure Leah's the fruitful one. But I want you to note something. Did you notice at the beginning of the reading, and it says, and Jehovah saw that Leah was hated, and he opened her womb. The open womb, the fruitfulness of Leah, was because God gave that to her because she didn't have anything else. And I think that's beautiful. The children of Israel are born into this world for a very, very big purpose. She becomes one of the mothers of the nation of Israel, whose job it is to be a light to the nation, a covenant of the peoples, to bring blessing to all the families of the earth. And Leah is part of that. And each time, at every turn, the birth of this miracle nation, both in the form of the original family and in the modern world, it requires a miracle by God. The miraculous womb, you know, we tend to think of Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel, but Leah doesn't get credit. We think of the miraculous births brought through Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel, but we always miss that God opened her womb too. She doesn't get credit for anything. Leah has 7 children, 6 boys, 1 girl, and we hear her sorrow in the names. Let's just quickly go through those. And I'm going to just read just the verses about the births of the children one more time. But this time I want you to listen as she names these children and hear her cry. Chapter 29, verse 32. Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reuven, for she declares, "It means the Lord has seen my affliction." It also means, "Now my husband will love me." First child, she admits that God has seen her lowness, and she's hopeful that her husband will love her because she has a son. But it doesn't appear to have worked. I would assume that gestation period is 9 months. At a minimum, she's got a little bit of time before she can get pregnant again. She does. She has a son. She still doesn't feel any better about her relationship. Verse 33, she conceived again and bore a son and declared, "This is because the Lord heard that I was unloved." Now, in Hebrew, it's hated. You can say unloved if you want. Either way, she's not loved. "And has given me this also." So she named him Simeon. We assume then that we go another 9 months and a little bit of time to recover from the delivery before she can get pregnant again. So at least about a year later, has the relationship got better for Leah? Says again, she conceived and bore a son and declared, "This time my husband will become attached to me or joined to me because I've borne him 3 sons. She feels unattached. She's not joined to her husband. See, you feel where she's coming from. And therefore, he was named Levi. Now, again, it could be that she names him Levi, too. I think she does. I don't think the Hebrew could be read a couple of ways. Okay. Another year, she conceives again and bore a son and declared, "This time I will praise the Lord," or thank the Lord. Therefore, she named him Judah and she stopped bearing. So I would propose to you at this point that after 4 sons and at least 4 years, she still doesn't feel the love. She doesn't feel respected, honored. She's not joined to her husband. He's not giving her any attention, or not much. Now, if you go to Genesis chapter 30, verse 17, God heeded Leah. She conceived and bore him a 5th son. I'm skipping the children born by the handmaids. That's another class. Just want to focus on the natural birthings of Leah. And Leah said, "God has given me my reward for having given my maid to my husband." So she named him Issachar. And let's see. So she feels that she's had to hire out. In a couple of occasions, she feels like she has to hire her husband. And this point comes out throughout the text, all right? So then it says in verse 19, Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a 6th son. Leah said, "God has given me an endowment, a choice gift. This time my husband will exalt me, for I have borne him 6 sons. So she named him Zebulon. And then she bore a daughter and named her Dina. And that's where the story ends. Dina means it's tied to the idea of judgment. She feels like the judgment has gone maybe in her favor. She's hopeful that with the birth of the daughter, that maybe that will help too. Maybe a dad's heart will be inclined towards his daughter. You see, every name is another indicator as to the depth of the pain in Leah. For years, this is not just, understand that this is after the 7 years. She's known Jacob for many years now. She's never felt loved the whole time. She's never been the choice. She's never been the gift. It's obvious that based on the names, these are just the notes that I jotted down, she feels afflicted, hated, isolated, ignored, low in the eyes of others, and not honored by her husband. Man. I'm not trying to be heavy this morning, but the story lends itself to see things through the eyes of an unloved person. These Torah stories can be about physical people, people who literally lived and walked and breathed and became great in many ways in these biblical narratives, but sometimes we don't take the time to get to know them, and I think this is important. Our Leah has tender and soft eyes. Perhaps soft from the tears. At one point, she says to Rachel in Genesis 30, you know, I tend to think of her as not fighting that much, even though she's in this bad place. Genesis chapter 30, verse 15, I see this as she is just fed up. Her son has gone out. He found these mandrakes, and we'll talk about that maybe a little bit. But she is blown away, I think, at the audacity of Rachel asking for the mandrakes. And she says in verse 15, was it not enough for you to take away my man? You'd also take my son's mandrakes? You see, she's like, you took my husband, and you are asking me to give you something else? Think about Leah. I think this was the out of desperation, out of frustration, out of years of bottling this second-class ranking until she finally just, she lets it out. And then she's quiet again. Because she's told, okay, you can sleep with him if you give me the mandrakes. You get that? In other words, you give me what I want, and he'll sleep with you, which indicates, I'm not expanding too much here, it indicates that normally she would sleep alone. She has to earn and buy a night with her man. And she makes the deal. Mandrakes, by the way, if you do a little study on it, they were believed to possess certain magical powers that in some writings it says that they serve as sort of an aphrodisiac even. But the idea is that magically they would not only create this great desire to have sex, I guess, but also to bear children. But look, Leah doesn't need that magic. So she can give the magic away. because that's not what's needed in the case of Leah. Jacob has four women. Leah, Rachel, Bilhah, and Zilpah. By the end of this story, he has had children with all of these women. The 11 boys so far, and Dinah. Now, we get very little in the story about Dinah. There is one story about her later, and that's all we get. So there's not much to say. But again, the Bible tends to focus on the men, and sometimes I'm just glad that it mentions her at all. I don't know that there were not others, but Dinah is mentioned. But in the sense of her name is associated with judgment. Now, there is one interesting thing that I found. We have Leah and Rachel are sisters, and we have Bilhah and Zilpah are maids that were given to the respective daughters. But according to Lewis Ginsburg, in 1909, he wrote or published Legends of the Jews. There is this Jewish legend, for whatever it's worth, that Bilhah and Zilpah are the half-sisters of Leah and Rachel. So all these women could be related. Who knows? I don't know. But be that as it may, Rachel is the one loved, and Leah is unloved. Now, I want to read to you from Deuteronomy 21. Now, this later becomes a Torah legislation, a Torah law, if you will, Deuteronomy 21, about what to do if you had more than one woman. And so it begins in Deuteronomy 21, verse 15. And this is the JPS, so it's not as literal. If a man has two women, one loved and the other unloved, Hebrew sunei, hated, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him sons, but the firstborn is the son of the unloved one, when he wills his property to his sons, he may not treat as firstborn the son of the loved one in disregard of the son of the unloved one who is older. Instead, he must accept the firstborn, the son of the unloved one, and allot to him a double portion of all he possesses, since he is the first fruit of his vigor. The birthright is his due. Right? So this is just a Torah law that says, in this ancient setting, if it doesn't say you have to, but if a person has more than one woman and they have children, both of them, you can't just pick and choose favorites and give to the one you love above and beyond the other if the right belongs to them. It's a semblance of trying to set in place rules to protect one who's not loved. And the Torah does this quite frequently. You know, because if there is a law, if you will, if there could be a law which seeks to make right all the wrongs of men, mankind, this is an attempt to do that. Because you might think that should go without saying. If the rule is that the firstborn gets it, you know, but you have to put it in writing. You have to, because otherwise somebody would say, well, I mean, technically it says the firstborn. This is a firstborn here. You know, I love this one better, so I'm going to give it. The Torah says, no, 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 no. You must go according to the birth order. Go with me to Ruth chapter 4. Ruth chapter 4. Let me see something. Make sure I have the right verse. I think it's verse 11. Yeah. Okay, here it is. So I'll be consistent, and I will read from the JPS again. And it says, all the people at the gate, Ruth 4:11, all the people at the gate, and the elders answered, we are. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built up the house of Israel. Prosper in Ephratah and perpetuate your name in Bethlehem. It becomes, if you will, a blessing. May the Lord make this woman like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built up, right? So notice they're both attributed, or it's attributed to both of them that they were used to build up this house that God designed, that he ordered. Now, you notice which one's mentioned first, right? Isn't that interesting? Now, some might say, well, that's scripture. That's the way it ought to be. I think it's saying something. Rachel always gets mentioned first. Leah always gets mentioned last. Hey, this might offend some. They might say, well, who are you to question how it says it in the book of Ruth? Relax. My job is to stir you. My job is to make you think. My job is to challenge things, and that encourages you to go dig. Why is it that Leah's mentioned after Rachel? Because she always is. Judaism will follow suit, probably based on Ruth chapter 4, verse 11. Whenever blessings are over the daughters, because they bless the daughters, you know, in Shabbat and so forth, you know what you say to your daughters? God make you like Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Leah. Yep. She's always coming up last. But for today, let's give the focus to Leah. She may not have been the most beautiful of form and appearance. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe she wasn't as attractive to Jacob, but she had soft and tender eyes, and she wanted to be wanted. Now, you guys probably don't think like I do, and you're probably too holy to have ever listened to a band called Cheap Trick. I don't know why I thought of this last night, but I thought of a lyric by a band known as Cheap Trick. I won't sing it for you, but the chorus says, I want you to want me. I need you to need me. I'd love you to love me. Those words, if you forgive my silly introduction of a rock and roll song into a Torah teaching, where else can you get stuff like this, right? It hit me in a strange way. A song that never moved me before, for the first time ever, moved me. I hadn't thought of that song in ages. And I could picture Leah singing that song. She just wants to be wanted. She just would love to be loved. And she just wants to be needed. She needs to be needed. Question for you today. Are you Leia? Do you know Leia? I hope that this teaching is a little bit different for me, I guess, in some ways. But it's, in a way, I'm hoping that this angle, that looking through Leia's eyes, will inspire each of us to look around us and say, do we know a Leia? Do we know somebody, anybody, that our actions have ignored, that we have maybe inadvertently made to feel low, whether it's your spouse, whether it's your mom, your sister, a stranger? We ought to be thinking like that, because as I read this story, I literally could envision Jacob's look when he sees it's Leia, and her sickening feeling when she sees how upset it is that it's her that he slept with. I could picture her crying as she heard him say to Laban, what have you done? I didn't work for her. I worked for Rachel. Why did you do? I could see her hearing that. How many times have we spoken about someone and they might have heard it? Or maybe they didn't. It doesn't matter. It's still bad. But maybe they did hear it. I hope that we think about the tender and soft-eyed among us. I hope that we think about how they view our actions towards them. Because here's a piece for you that's real important. They're not the only ones that see how they're treated. They may feel alone, but how many times does it say in today's Torah reading, God heard, God answered, God moved on behalf of the one less loved? See, when we treat someone with hatred or malice or even ignoring someone or making them feel badly, you got to be real careful, because that person is likely calling out to God. And you know whose name keeps going up to God? Ross did this to me. Ross said this to me. Ross mistreated me. Ross doesn't love me. Think about, you know, and there are places in the Torah where it says be careful, because they'll call out to God. You know, I mean, really, if you do a poor person wrong and they call out to God, what does the Torah say happen? You don't want to go there. Think about that. Go with me to Proverbs 31. You know this. This is Eshet Chayel, the virtuous woman, it's called, Proverbs 31. Here's what it says. In English, it says, grace is deceptive. In Hebrew, sheker, it's a lie. Grace is a lie, right? Beauty is illusory. It's for her fear of Jehovah that a woman is to be praised, right? So we have to think about this. We tend to look at the outside. God looks at the inside. We tend to think certain things are beautiful. It may or may not be what God sees as beautiful. We have to be careful in our judgment. The ancient scribes and sages who recorded lessons according to these ancient triennial cycles associated a verse with this Torah reading, and it's from Isaiah chapter 60, verse 15. It is in context talking about Israel, some of which descend from Leah. But it was applied to Leah by the ancient scribes who tied these verses together. And notice what it says. Isaiah 60:15. Whereas you've been forsaken, rejected, with none passing through, I will make you a pride everlasting, a joy for age after age. Maybe today's lesson gave a little due to Leah. Shabbat shalom.